Blog Talk Radio.
Somewhere in deepest space, all hell is breaking loose.
They cut the power.
How did they cut the power, man? The animal.
Get them out of there!
Aliens. This time, it's war. The new movie, rated R.
Welcome to the Movie Geeks United Summer of 1986 series. Tonight, we celebrate James Cameron's epic sci-fi action classic, Aliens. Released on July 18, 1986, Aliens took the baton from Ridley Scott's haunting and visionary 1979 original film and redefined it as a lean, muscular, and deeply felt war film. We begin our celebration tonight with actor Michael Biehn, who portrays Corporal Hicks in the film, a tough but compassionate soldier who fights valiantly to protect Ripley and his squad from the lethal threat of an alien army. Mr. Biehn had worked with Cameron previously as Kyle Reese in The Terminator and would return for a third collaboration on 1989's underwater spectacle, The Abyss. Since these collaborations, Mr. Biehn has worked with several other master filmmakers, including William Friedkin, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino. In addition to his acting duties, his latest film, titled The Victim, also finds him in the director's chair.
Jim Cameron was the first guy that I worked with that every detail had to be perfect. Whether it was the smoke in the background, whether it was the how much the wind was blowing the hair, whether it was how much blood, you know, he'd get in there and do the blood makeup. He'd get in there and, you know, he was hands-on, and he made sure that what was in that frame, he used to carry around a little, back in Aliens, it was the first time I'd ever seen anybody carry around a recorder or a video feed. And but even doing The Terminator and dailies and so on and so forth, his attention to detail did not, he taught me at a very early age that what we're doing is war. It doesn't have to be ugly, you know, to do it the way that you want to do it. Everything has to be perfect. Everything inside of that frame has to be perfect. And, you know, sometimes you know, like Sidney Lumet says, you know, you plan, you start shooting, and from then on in, you compromise. And Jim would probably tell you the same thing, but Jim's attention detail is beyond reproach. I mean, and another guy that is like that I worked with twice and did two films for is Friedkin. I mean, Friedkin is a maniac. Like, I'm a maniac, you know, on the set. And he scares people. But his passion for getting truth from the written word onto film is like none other. And he's made, you know, you could take The French Connection and you could take The Exorcist and I think it was called The Sorcerer. And I mean, in those three movies alone, I mean, French Connection is probably the best cop movie that's ever been made. And I believe The Exorcist is the greatest horror movie ever made. And his attention to detail is, you know, just, you know, he, you know, there'll be a scene going on and he'll cut the scene and go back and school a extra who's supposed to be a detective, who's supposed to be searching something. And he's, you know, he'll grab that guy and say, you're not looking at anything. You're just kind of, you know, like wandering around. Look, I want you to look. I see you're in a closet here. You're just kind of, no, look in the pockets of the closet, you know. Look above, look below. Could there anything be anything under the carpet, you know. Take your flashlight, look up at the ceiling, look at, you know. And he, you know, he'll school an extra for 5 minutes about how to search a closet if you're a cop. When the scene is, you know, me and David Caruso and, you know, Chaz Palminteri out at the front, you know, and that attention to detail, I think, rubs off on me and has. But and I've worked with a lot of guys that do. I mean, not only Friedkin and Jim, but also Rodriguez, and obviously Quentin Tarantino. Michael Bay is the same way. I forget the name of the guy who did The Seventh Sign, but he was the same way. A lot of the really good filmmakers are the ones that are, you know, a little bit nutty when it comes to their movies, and a little bit intimidating because,
and very, very strong-willed. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Because you mentioned Friedkin, just reflecting on some moments in Rampage, it terrifies me. That movie is still terrifying to me.
I'll tell you, that movie was kind of overlooked. It was made by Dino De Laurentiis, and about the time that was supposed to be released, his company folded, and it sat around for a while. Miramax picked it up, recut it. It's a great little movie. It's got an incredible score. It's got a score by Sergio Leone. Yeah, Morricone, I mean, yeah. And it is a very scary movie, and there's a mood about that movie, and there was a mood on that set. And that, I think, is what, you know, Friedkin, for all of his madness, brings to a movie set is a mood. And he probably did it when he did The Exorcist. And I don't know if he has the ability anymore at his age. But when you worked for Billy back in those days, you had better be on your toes, and you had better be dedicated and passionate and give everything that you have to him and his movie, or he will rip you a new asshole in a fucking heartbeat, you know. But I love the guy. And when he's not on the set, he's not like that at all, you know, completely laughing, joking, you know, having a great time, play cards with you, and talk history, talk music, laugh, go to lunch, everything, you know. Like, he's a different animal when he gets on the set. Or when he gets into a looping room. I mean, I have sat and looped the same line over for Billy Friedkin for 3 hours. The same line over and over and over for 3 hours. And when I finally, with him getting pissed, and, no, Michael, do it again, you know. And then, you know, then finally fucking get it, only to get a call that night saying he wants me to come back and do it again the next day. It's intimidating, but you have to admire somebody who cares so much.
You were kind of a last-minute replacement for Aliens.
I was. I got called by Friday, I think, by Gail Hurd. She asked me if my passport was in order. I told her it was, and I believe I was shooting Monday morning in at Pinewood Studios. And I didn't have to go through any of the 3 weeks of bullshit Marine training, you know, that they put all the actors through with some, you know, retired drill sergeant or something. And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, was that call. That's what happened. I got called on Friday. I went to work on Monday. The very first scene I shot was the scene where we find Nuke, and I reach down, she bites me or something like that, I look down and, oh, hi honey, or something, like whatever I say to her, I smile at her. And Jim said to me the next day, he said, you know, Michael, I can see that you're going to bring a completely different level to this, to Hicks, because we always saw him, me and the other actor, always saw him as this tough, kind of mean, kind of whatever. And And when he had played the scene, he was kind of angry or whatever. And so I brought kind of this light touch, sort of this
a compassion,
reluctant hero, some compassion. There's a scene where I remember it like yesterday, that there was a scene that was written where Newt picks up one of the bombs, and it was scripted. It was, don't touch that, you know. And I said, Jim, let me say, don't touch that, you know, it could hurt you. So, you know, it just takes a, you know, and the character was written more as kind of a gruff, tough, you know, like non-caring Marine. And I thought what I was able to bring to the character was kind of this reluctant kind of hero, and kind of a guy who did cared about the little girl, cared about Ripley, cared about his buddies and his friends, and you know, when Hudson goes down and I'm trying to save him, it's a horrible moment. It, you know, for me as an actor, and you know, never really played on screen because we never got that close in on Hicks, but when I lose, you know, lose Paxton as they pull him down, I mean, it's just you know, a horrific thing for Hicks, and you don't, you know, there's too much going on to really pay much attention to it. But there's one thing I didn't like about it, and that was that they made me wear the same shield that the other actor had worn. And what happened was they gave these shields to the actors, and they said, okay, this is your armor. If you feel like, you know, drawing something on there, putting something on there, like, you know, your name or your girlfriend's name or mom or, you know, whatever, have fun with it. Do whatever you want. So everybody did theirs. Well, the actor before me, he drew a big red pink heart on his and put it right where your heart was. And I remember looking at that shield and thinking, that looks like a fucking bullseye to me, man. You know, it was bright pink or bright red, and I hated it. And I said, Jim, can we paint over this? Can we do something? No, we've already got some other shots. I think they used some, I don't know if it ever made it into the film, but at that point they had done some with the other actor, and you couldn't see who it was, but you could see the shield, and so he wouldn't let me paint that over. But I had a lot of fun making it, a lot of great memories. Gail and... you know, Gail and Jim have been great friends of mine throughout the years. I'm still, Bill Paxton and I have done 5 movies together. It was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time. And I had a great, great time making the movie. The sets were fabulous. We're at Pinewood Studios. Pacino was making Revolution. They were doing Little Shop of Horrors. Val Kilmer was doing his I Spy movie or whatever that was. And it was just a great time. And back then the dollar was a little stronger than it was. And so we had a lot of fun in London while we were working. I met my second wife there and just had a great time. We were living in Chelsea and just had a great time.
London crews are a bit different, though, aren't they? Didn't you guys have some difficulties with the crews there?
I didn't have any difficulties. Jim might have had some difficulties. Jim didn't like the tea breaks very much. And these guys had basically been around Pinewood for 40 years, and they had their way of doing things. And, you know, here comes this 30-year-old kid coming in there, you know, saying, well, we're going to do it this way, not that way. Well, they don't know he's a, they don't know he's a genius, so they you know, grumble and mumble. And I never had any problems with the crew. And I think that you know, for all the talk about how difficult Jim can be, I did 3 films for him, and really I just worked a little bit on T2, but you know, I never saw Jim ever really go anywhere near the point of what I was doing on my movies. You know, I mean, the worst thing Jim ever said to me was, you know, after a shot or a rehearsal, he would come to me and he'd said, that's exactly what I don't want. Okay, so I mean, that, you know, it kind of summarizes up Jim, that like, and me being me, it was like, okay, Jim, since you can't play me, and, you know, why don't you give me a sign reading, and I'll do it like you want me to do it. And we do it like that, and, you know, we've been friends ever since. I mean, we, you know, he didn't used to treat his actors like they were something special, you know. They were like little, like, delicate little creatures, you know. And some actors were used to being treated that way. On the flip side of that is that he used to always want us to be coming into the cutting room, coming in, watching dailies, coming in, watching scenes cut together, watching, you know, he wanted us involved, where, you know, the other directors, it used to be, Jamie, used to be like, well, you don't want the actors to come in and see dailies because if they see themselves and they see something that they don't like, they're going to change their performance. What a bunch of fucking horseshit that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I would. And if that's the case, then it would make it better, you know. But Jim used to, all the way going back to the Terminator times, you know, he was always, Michael, come look at this. You know, I've got Technoir cut. You know, it's a rough cut, but take a look, you know. And the music will hit here and here. What do you think? You know, and I'd give him my 2 cents. And he was like that on The Abyss, and he was like that on Aliens, and he was very, very inclusive when it came to his footage and you looking at his footage and wanting to have all his actors sit around after a 16-hour day and sit and watch dailies with him. First time a director's ever wanted me to see dailies, but goddamn, it's 16 hours, man. I want to go home and go to sleep, you know. I swear to God, I can remember many a day working on an Alien set where we would put in a 14, 15-hour day, and then Jim would say, let's go watch dailies, and actors would look at each other like, oh, God, do we have to, you know? And some would and some wouldn't, but he was very, very inclusive that way.
What strikes me most about him is the fact that it always seems like he's looking for the next seemingly impossible challenge. And I guess with Aliens, it would be to make a follow-up to such a classic kind of sci-fi horror film. And his ingenious way of doing it was to have it be a different animal altogether. I mean, this is as badass and as lean an action movie as you can get. It's one of the most exciting action movies I've ever seen. It's completely a different animal from the first Alien.
Well, you know, you're right. I think that it was Bill Paxton who first saw the movie and called it a roller coaster ride. And that got picked up on by the press, and people started calling it that. And that's all I can say is that you're right. And here we are 30 years later, and I've got this little movie that you see that basically is a character-driven piece that is more along the lines of Aliens, because I didn't have the money to do any action and so on and so forth. There's a little bit, but not too much. And it's more like I always describe Aliens was like you're walking through a dark funhouse, you know, and it's creepy and it's creepy and it's creepy, and all of a sudden, oh my God, you know, and you get scared, and then it was creepy and then it was creepy, and it was like walking through a funhouse, where Jim's movie was like a roller coaster ride. Well,
just let me know what it was like to work alongside Sigourney Weaver, because this is one of the great iconic characters that she created.
Well, I've always felt that Sigourney is what she brings to that character. I find is truthful with her in life. You know, she is a very, very strong woman. I mean, I don't know how else to say it except for that my feeling about Sigourney Weaver is the closest thing that you're going to find to Sigourney Weaver as a person is the character of Ripley. And that is, you know, a compliment, because she is strong, she is assertive, she makes the right decisions when men don't. She is compassionate with a little girl. She has feelings. She can be fun, as in the scene where I offer her the bracelet. She is a professional, and she is there for that set with nude on her back for, you know, 2 days in a row, you know. Never complains. Never, you know, a hardworking, brilliant actress who is joy to work with because she's such a professional and such a strong woman.
We got 15 of these M40 grenades. Don't touch that. dangerous, honey.
Is the only flamethrower?
Yeah, it's only half full, but it's functional. And another one damaged. I don't know about that one.
How long after we're declared overdue can we expect to wreck you?
17 days.
17 days? Hey, man, I don't want to rain on your parade. We're not going to last 17 hours. Those things are going to come in here just like they did before, and they're going to come in here, and they're going to come in here, and they're going to get us.
This little girl survived longer than that with no weapons and no training.
In a career spanning nearly 40 years and countless indelible performances, from Dog Day Afternoon to Near Dark to his searing portrayal of Frank Black in Chris Carter's hit TV series Millennium, Lance Henriksen has solidified his status as one of our most versatile and beloved character actors. Now, Mr. Henriksen has chronicled his remarkably colorful and passionate journey in a new book titled Not Bad for a Human, which is now available for purchase from our show page. In this conversation, Mr. Henriksen discusses his approach to the craft of acting and what many consider the defining performance of his career as the loyal android Bishop in James Cameron's Aliens. A big part of the book that was of particular interest to me was that you said that every time you finish a job, the predominant feeling you have is that you don't know who you are. And that got me thinking about actors and the process that they go through and their own sense of self and how that factors into to what they do.
Yeah, it's true. It really happens. I mean, I don't think I'm unique in that. I think maybe people don't verbalize it, or they push past the feeling, you know, and do something to maybe cover it up or to fill the gap, you know. But I think people do that, you know. But yeah, it's something, man. It always happens, but it's always a shock. It mostly happens when you're doing something that you tried to contribute a lot to, you know, and it was a long enough time where you suddenly put yourself aside.
Well, when I speak to actors, and I, especially actors that have been in the business for many years, as you have, I ask them if their approach or what they get out of acting has changed now from when they started, and a lot of actors say that in their approach they've become more efficient, that they're not so inspired to throw in everything but the kitchen sink, and it kind of makes it easier to live with. Did you reach that stage too?
Well, it depends on the challenge, you know. I mean, I think you know, if the role is a visiting character, you know, in a movie, you know, that isn't very protracted, then that's the case. You would be more economical, and you try to look for some kind of inspiration. But when you're in a film for a long period of time, the difference is you have to really draw on something. And I was just talking to a director this morning, you know, a guy I really respect, Richard Gibson. He's from Australia, mm-hmm. and we have done a short together called Message from Fallujah. But we were talking about this new material he's working on, and I thought it suddenly hit me like. I always call it channeling, that some thought comes through your mind. And I said, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is that we're all one. I mean, that's the thing that we're all forgetting, that a lot of the channeling that happens, that I call it channeling, you go through these phases. One is you're gathering what seems to be obvious in a way, and then it comes channeling, which is almost like we have a collective mind, that if there's an issue that's an unfulfilled issue out there floating in the air, because we're all really connected, that's my opinion anyway, that issue will come through you, channel through you. Because I sometimes say things and I go, where the hell did that come from? I mean, that understanding of something or a line of dialogue that just comes from a source that I hadn't known, that I really hadn't connected with before that moment. So, it's the whole process, I guess the intensity of it is different for everybody, depending on where they came from. You know, all roads to acting or to the filmmaking or the arts like that, we all come from somewhere else, you know, different places.
When you're preparing a role and you're kind of channeling, as you said, the ideas and the themes that you want to explore in these characters, how do you go about doing that? What helps stimulate that for you beyond the script?
But the script sets up a narrative, you know, and sets up without restraint, there's no art. So the script is the art. I mean, that's the restraint.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. I'm working on something right now that came out of nowhere. I did a movie with Michael Wirth about a Sasquatch. But while we were working on that film, he had an idea. And now we've done it. And that was years ago. And now we've done it. And the movie is Bring Me the Head of Lance Henriksen. That's what the movie is. That's the name of it. That's what it's about. What it's about is ageism in the industry. If you're over 40, there's a decline in the outlook on you doing certain roles, right? So, but what we dealt with, we improvised the whole movie, everything. And Tim Thomerson really stars in it, and Adrian Barbeau is in it, and, you know, a lot of actors from Hollywood. But what the struggle is how do you have a, you know, restraints and you have a narrative that's going on like this, and then improvise the whole thing. And the truth of it is, everybody is finding that they're channeling a lot of ideas that they don't live with on a daily basis. They do, but it's unconscious. You know, we all live in a lot of denial. We know we're going to die, but you don't want to live with that in the forefront. Otherwise, you're a vampire, you know, But the point is, though, that it became so exciting and interesting and fun to do and funny that it all was channeling. We ended up, you know, every character found its own place, their own place in the story, their own gift to give to this thing. So, I don't know where it's headed, whether it'll be a film on the screen or will it be a series on Showtime or home HBO, or we don't know. But nobody cares. What we're really into is, let's do this thing and do it as well as we can and see what happens. How do you do it? I mean, really what your question is not easy, because one of the things, how do you do it depends on the chemistry of the people involved, you know, and so how do you breed that? How do you put away the diva forever and just do this good job, you know? I've never been a diva, but I'm just saying the diva element.
right.
I'm very low maintenance. I mean, I really love what we do, so I'm really low maintenance about it. You know, except that I will spend from my own pocket to make it right, to make it work.
Well, and that's apparent in a lot of the anecdotes you share in the book. And you were talking about Bring Me the Head of Lance Henriksen, which is the all-time greatest title in the history of film. That's a great title. But you also, I mean, there have been a couple of films that you've done where you have requested that you improvise your role.
That's right.
Yeah, and so freedom must play an important factor in getting into these characters' skins for you.
Well, it does. It does on every level, because really, we all flourish with freedom. I mean, freedom to love the way we want to with a wife or a girlfriend or, you know, all the freedoms that we search for, that's happiness. I mean, it's not the objects, these dead objects that we buy, that's freedom. It's the living things, you know, like a dog or a horse or a person or an environment with a bunch of people or going to a faraway place where you're witnessing something you've never seen before, an interaction between people. Mm-hmm. So the couple of movies that I've done that in, I realized I was on a precipice. And that was, the precipice was this, that if I did it the way it was written, it would end up not being a force of any kind. It would not offer an environment where everything would flourish and come alive. And there was only a couple of times that it happened. But it was really based on the character. I knew that I just didn't want to do a cliche characterization of something. I really wanted to see where the hell that led. To do this guy, what does it mean? Why am I doing it? You know, and that's the personal part. But then I said to, I remember, it's in the book, I said to Jim Jarmusch, Jim, I don't want to say a line you wrote. And he said, well, what would you do then if you didn't? And I said, well, we'll find it on the moment. And I was so gratified that he embraced the idea with me, trusted me,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That all kinds of wonderful things happened during that movie. And I don't know that I have any right to do that. I mean, a lot of people protect their material because they've got so much money invested in it, you know, like a studio. It would be hard to imagine me going into Avatar and saying, look, I just want to improvise my role. You know, I mean, you couldn't do that, not in that circumstance. And I would
right,
know the difference.
Right.
I have a good sense of circumstance, so I know the difference, but then the couple of times that I did it, it was very successful to me. Like
well,
Stone Cold was another one.
Right. Yeah, Stone Cold, yeah.
Yeah, with that character, I knew I had to search for him because I didn't want to do a cliche and I didn't know who the hell he was. I found it on film, which is great.
Well, speaking of freedom and kind of finding it in film, a lot of actors, when you talk to them, they feel their ultimate freedom on stage. So the film medium as it is, tell me about the process you went through to feel comfortable with the camera and your relationship to the camera
point. I mean, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have been comfortable in film if I hadn't done stage. Because really, stage, you know, if you're in an theater, you're still blocking is the great supporter of all time. I mean, when you find where the guy moves and how he moves in that environment, which is all imaginary, by the way, it's all supported by blocking and language and mm-hmm. lighting. You know, I mean, it's a very unique place to act. But when you get into film, now you're suddenly in real environments. And you have marks to hit for focus and all that stuff. Well, all the blocking I did for theater served me well in film because I don't block. Putting marks on the ground and telling me where I have to land like a Pavlovian dog with a, and you get a cookie if you do it right, you know, doesn't offend me or bop me or even isn't noticeable. My big joke is put a stack of per diem there and I'll hit that mark much better. Believe me. I'm kidding, but anyway, that's a joke. You know, but the thing is, all of these things serve each other. But the one thing that film has is intimacy. Real intimacy. And I think I did like that because I would rather be whispering in a girl's ear than screaming at her from down the block.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, and you tell a story that relates that where you got your first kind of taste of how perceptive that film camera is in A Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, God, yeah. And how perceptive a director can be. Yeah.
Lumet. So, oh, man.
Yeah, what a great guy. Really, what a great guy. Yeah, I mean, those are miracles, but believe me, my heart was open to accept it, you know, just accept it for what it is. And it took a long time. It didn't happen overnight. Really,
yeah.
It did not happen overnight. You know, I've done a lot of movies and been in a lot of circumstances, you know, so. And I still love it. And if I get bored, then I'll go just start making pottery all the time.
right. You started a relationship with Mr. Cameron at the very beginning with Piranha 2.
I was down in Jamaica with him. And again, you know, there was a certain reality, and that was the budget of the film. I mean, there was no budget. It was very low budget. He's a guy that no matter what the budget is, every dollar is going to be up on that screen, every
mm-hmm.
cent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even the point of saying, yeah, you know, I bought a waiter's, you know, outfit, his chinos with the stripe down the side and all of that because I was playing a harbor cop and I gave him $75 for it. Right off his body, I will change and go, give me that. What you're wearing. That's what I wore through the whole movie. I mean, it was, and Jim was in his room making rubber fish because they didn't give him enough money for it, but he was determined to have enough.
Mm-hmm.
And all that stuff, man, I mean, that's magic. That's like, I'm not going to quit. There's no quit in it. There's no quit in doing this. And I love that part, man. That's like gypsies. You know, we got to eat tonight. Now, what are we going to do? How are we going to drum up the money to eat?
Mm.
So, you know, you make an instrument out of a pot and you get out there and you try to get the money.
Well, that's what came across in your book, because your strength and dedication to each of your roles, I mean, the kind of immersive quality that you don't go in halfway.
Really, when you get down to it, that's the only skill I've got. I'm a primitive. I mean, really, I mean, I have done some very sophisticated characters, but, you know, like when I did Millennium, Frank Black was certainly much more educated and much more mainstream than I am. And so I had to live up to that. And what course do you use, if you're me, to try to find that? You know, and, mm-hmm. and you had to dig. I had to dig deep. And I was grateful for the opportunity. I really mm-hmm. was. I mean, a part of me loved playing Frank Black.
Yeah.
What a dignified human being. Even, you know, moments, I mean, a more superficial moment. I remember playing, you know, I was one of the astronauts in the Mercury astronauts and Wright stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we shot a scene where we were arriving in Texas, you know, Sally Ride is dancing the feather dance up on the stage, and we're riding in, and there's a giant Texas barbecue in Houston. We're all arriving. The Mercury 7 astronauts, and we're all coming in, sitting on the back of Lincoln's. You know, they were, and I got such a feeling of patriotism out of it. It was just, it was like when I played Lincoln. I suddenly felt very patriotic about these men and what they did and when they did it.
Yeah.
And even when I played Lincoln, the thing that moved me the most was that Bloomingdale had done embroidery inside his coat, and it was a beautiful giant eagle. And because Bloomingdale loved Lincoln, and so things like that, those details, just fill your heart. I mean, how can they
if you're really
aware of what it meant?
And that was such a personal kind of act for him, because it's not on display for everyone to see. I mean, it reflected their feelings for him.
That's right. It was inside his jacket. It wasn't, you know, like a motorcycle guy on the back of his jacket. It was so personal.
Yeah.
Just all that. I mean, this is what I love about it. Imagine where I would be had I not gone this course. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have been a writer. There's not going to be a second biography. This is it. That was it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm
grateful
for it, and I'm grateful it's resonating with a lot of people. So the miracle of that I'm here today, sitting in my house, talking to you on the phone about something that resonated with you, and that's an amazing phenomenon right there.
It's a fantastic book. I think that's the nature of any art form, whether it's books, films, music. It's conveying an idea. It's like what you were talking about before. We're all kind of one. And I think that's what draws us to any kind of art is to sense ultimately that we're not alone.
We're not alone. We're all a part of something that we're all a part of. You know the other thing about writing a book like this, and I never dreamt that we would be successful, but there are a lot of people in a lot of walks of life that really struggle with their inner thoughts and how well they're doing on their road, their mm-hmm. life road, whatever you want to call it. And movies certainly give us a chance to, you know, live without fear for those moments that we're in a theater talking about issues that normally would be frightening, maybe. Or maybe mm-hmm. non-supportive, or maybe all of those issues. I'm not talking like a psychiatrist, but what I do mean is that I just really want to give the nod to anybody that is on the road, that is less traveled, mm-hmm. so to speak. You know, you, that to tell the truth, that helps anybody. I mean, if people told me the truth every day of my life, I would be one happy guy, man. But it's the implicit kind of, you know, talking around it, or you know, people just don't know how to, they don't know how to come forward, come straight, you know, with things. And I'm finding now that that's like one of the best gifts we have as human beings. I mean, we can tell the truth. That's really cool.
He never said anything about an android being on board. Why not?
It never occurred to me. It's common practice. We always have a synthetic on board.
I prefer the term artificial person myself. Is there a problem?
I'm sorry. I don't know why I didn't even... Ripley's last trip out, the artificial person malfunctioned.
Malfunctioned?
There were problems, and a few deaths were involved.
I'm shocked. Was it an older model?
Yeah, the Hyperdyne system's 128.2.
Well, that explains it, and the A2s always were a bit twitchy.
First of all, about aliens and your conception of the Bishop character, how did you go about building that character?
That's a very good question, because one of the things was that you had Rutger Hauer and you had the other guy that was...
Ian Holm. Yeah,
Ian Holm, this wonderful actor. And you had those guys do these incredible performances of androids, or so-called androids, artificial people, whatever. But and I thought, how can I do this and you know, not... I suddenly felt, you know, at first in competition, said, well, I got to be doing that. I got to do this really great, because look what they did. And then I realized, wait a minute, calm down, jeez. I'm scaring the shit out of myself. And really, really what happened was I said, I have to find this. I have to find it myself. And I suddenly realized that he was alien even to the aliens and to the people, because he was an android. I mean, he was created, but it was certainly suddenly a creature that's self-aware, like a computer that's self-aware, mm-hmm. to some degree. And all life was beautiful to him, because that's not what he was. And I thought, I felt that way when I was 12. I'd already left home. I was traveling the highways and riding freight trains and all these things. And I thought, I felt that alien. I mean, that's how I felt that alien. And even to the point where people, adults who were abusive, I would look at them and say, I'm going to outlive you. So I can give you a pass on this. I mean, you don't know what you're doing. You're hurting me for no reason. You know, for no good reason, that's for sure. And so there were, when I look back on it all, I thought, this is almost the perfect analogy for where Bishop is at. Mm-hmm. You know, he's serving people. You know, you want to be liked and loved, so you do these things, and you take care of, you know, you rescue your parents when they're off the wall, you know, because you love them, basically. Mm-hmm. And so that characteristic is what I dealt with and did to do Bishop. And the other part was also that in a way you could use this analogy. If during apartheid I was a black in South Africa, you don't want to make any bad moves, because mm-hmm. you'll just be, you know, you'll be, you know, it won't be right. It won't work. It'll be bad. And so when I kept those things in mind constantly through the thing, it became an act of discovery. I mean, it was, weapons meant nothing to me. I realized what was of value to me. In fact, there's a funny story, man. I tried to prepare so much for it that I found a designer to start designing costumes for me to wear. And also I went and got sclerals to go in my eyes that had two pupils in each eye. And Jim ran a test of it, and he said, it looks scarier than the alien, so we're not using it. Because I thought when he got alerted, he might have two pupils in each eye so that he could know. He wouldn't miss anything.
Mm.
Like something attacked, he would just go, bling, and have two pupils in each eye. It was too creepy. I went and bought those. That was my own idea. So anyway.
Mm. Well, you try so much, try out so many ideas to make the character truthful for yourself. And I'm wondering, is there a point in filming where you think to yourself, I've got it, or is it still a constant kind of search to the end?
Well, it is a search till the end, but it takes a different form. It's not the externals or the internals. It suddenly becomes, what are the challenges? I remember, Jim, they were welding me into a pipe to crawl out to the uplink tower. And Jim handed me a gun right as they were going to close the lid. He handed me a gun, and I looked at it, and it was a Jim offering a challenge. He said, what do you think? What would Bishop do with this gun without saying it? He just handed it to me, and I looked at it like, what the hell? And I handed it off. And then I rolled over the tunnel, and they welded me in, and I went. But it's like, what? You know, those are the greatest moments, is when a director goes and gives you a challenge right on the moment. No talk, no nothing, just gives you the challenge. And then you react, you respond to what you're doing, your character. What does he need a gun for? He doesn't want to kill anything.
Right.
You know. And later years, Jim said to me, you know, I always thought of bringing Bishop back and having somebody toyed with his brain. And he senses it. He knows it happened but doesn't know what it is. But he has this sense of dread all the time. And he has to wrestle with that. So it was a great idea. Beautiful.
It is a great idea. Wow. Bishop is a character that has followed you these past decades. I mean, you've gone back and you've portrayed kind of different aspects of him in other Alien.
Well, and I know my life, sure.
Yeah. So I would think that this character has special meaning for you personally.
It does, because really those things that I'm talking about how I approach this, they were a secret, and I was just doing it. I had to audition with Jim and Gail, and because there was a rule in England, you know, that if you have to see every actor that could possibly play that role of Bishop. And Jim actually told me, he said, if I'd seen somebody better, I would have hired them. And he's not being mean or anything like that. I mean, he's just telling the truth. And I was using what I was using, and it seemed, I even dyed my hair a particular color. I dyed it a plum color. And the reason was, I knew that under lights, that it would look like copper. The highlights would be copper. And so, I also shaved all the hair off my body. So my arms had no hair on them. I mean, so there was like a baby aspect to it. You know, like a, you know, that baby skin, good skin. And all those details, I mean, those, the things that worked, they stayed, and the things that didn't, they were gone. But Bishop has maintained, and I think the reason is, and I've always been affectionate toward that role, was because I had decided before I did that role, I think I enjoyed myself very much in Terminator, but because it was Paul Winfield and I were very funny together, we really enjoyed each other, so that was a cop relationship that was very, very kind of alive. But Bishop, if I had done all that work and didn't see it when I saw the movie, I was literally going to quit acting. So forget it. I'm done. I don't want to just service movies like a, you know, I have to use this phrase, and you can cut it out if you want, but yeah, so stand around with a pole up my ass just trying to serve the movie and not bring any of myself to it. You know what I mean? I was ready to quit. And it was such a, it ended up being a lyric character and a misunderstood character and all that stuff. And I loved it. I really loved it when I saw it. I was very proud of it.
Oh, it's one of the great movies of the past 25 years, without a doubt.
And it holds up. I mean, I saw it. I'm going to be seeing it on Saturday at the Egyptian. They're doing Jeanette and a lot of people are going to be there for that. Rolston, Gail Hurd's going to be there. Yeah, it holds up. People really enjoy it. I actually was, I think I was in Austin, Texas, and they showed it. And it was one of those nights, you know, like where everybody was saying all the lines in the movie really loud. So the competition was everybody was saying everybody's lines. It was hilarious, man. I was standing in the back like, what the hell is this Rocky Horror show? You know? It was fun, man. Fans are, you know, people, the tribe. I don't call them fans anymore. I call them the tribe.
Yeah. You know, you said something interesting, though. Years ago, I was listening to an interview with Jack Nicholson, and he said that in a lot of scenes, he tries to have a secret that isn't explicit. The audience doesn't know anything about it. His fellow actors don't know anything about it, but it brings a certain special spontaneity and surprising quality to the scene for him.
That's exactly correct. I didn't know he said that, but that's really good, man. I think that's always been an issue with me because I don't want to talk about anything negative, but there is a potential if you don't keep it a secret that you'll just piss it away. It'd be like talking too much about a role rather than investing in the role. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine has two great quotes that I love. One is, the only way for a turtle to move forward is he's got to stick his neck out.
Mm.
I love that one.
Mm.
And the other one is really good, and that is that if you're having breakfast in the morning, and the difference between being committed and being involved, if you were the chicken, you were involved. If you were the pig, you were committed.
That's great. Okay, just a couple of quick listener questions, and then I'll let you off the hook. You've been so nice to give me so much time.
Oh, you're welcome, my friend. Thank you. You're supporting my book like crazy, and I appreciate it. Really do.
Oh, we're gonna sell it like hotcakes off of our show page.
It's on Amazon. It's on. Yeah, by the end of next week, it'll be on Kindle Nook and all the rest of it. But it's on Amazon but not Brooks Brothers.
It's even at Brooks Brothers as well. Yeah.
No. Barnes & Noble, sorry.
Heather wants to know,
yeah.
First of all, Heather wanted me to ask you a question that I refuse to ask you. Her first question was, why is he so damn hot? But I said I can't ask that question. She actually wants to know
well,
how you...
Well, that's because she doesn't know me.
So she came back.
The hottest, the ones you don't know, you just met. Hey, go ahead. I'm sorry.
She came back with a legitimate question here, where she wants to know about your near dark experience and that character that you portrayed.
Oh boy, that's really interesting. You know, that was matriarch Catherine Bigelow. When she directs, she is one of you. I mean, you are family, and that was a family, by the way. And we all had come from Aliens to do that movie, and we already knew each other and trusted each other. So to get into these issues that these characters had was so wonderful to do. I mean, but she would throw up a challenge like, look, there's a sunlit room behind this door, and I'm going to give you whatever you need to go in there and survive it. And so she gave us a roll of tinfoil and a blanket and spray cans. And we went in and did an Elvis. You know, Elvis used to put tinfoil on the windows so you can keep the light out. But if we get hit by the light, it's a bad burn. I mean, or could he kill us first in the flames? So there was these challenges that were set up. And the whole environment working with her was just, it was about as romantic as you can get. I mean, and to play a character like those that live forever and have the sort of sympathy for the dying breed that the humans were, and we were also nocturnal nomads that were thinning out the herd, you know, horrible people or you know, people that couldn't run fast enough. And it was, I know, that sounds so sick. But there was an issue. I remember going to Chartoff and Winkler and saying, Bill and I want to do a prequel to this movie. And he said, well, why? You answer the question, why would anybody care about these people? And I'll give you the rights. And I said, well, because they care about each other. That's what makes it, you know, makes it work.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't do it. I mean, there was just no way to do it. That's really Catherine's baby. She wrote it with Eric Red. And I surrendered immediately. I realized, you know, that's where that needed to go. If it was ever going to be done, it would be her doing it. Bill and I were just so enthusiastic. I mean, we saw burning horses running out of barns back in the 1800s. You know, we had a whole scenario worked out already.
You know, you talk about these great filmmakers that you've worked with, Cameron and Bigelow and Lumet and Walter Hill.
Sure, I love Walter. Yeah.
Do you always, because it's you've Jarmusch done so too. Many Jarmusch, exactly. But you've done so many films, and I know that there are some films where you know the directors you work with are phenomenal and very helpful, and they're bound to be some that they're not. But
that's right. I mean, I call those alimony films, and there's also a film that I call called jet lag films, where mm-hmm. you get off the plane and go right to work in Eastern Europe, and you can't even. You don't even know your name. I mean, let alone start talking and filming.
But do you always feel like you give your best work under those kinds of directors, like Bigelow and Cameron, the really involved directors? Yeah,
of course, because they have one thing in common, man. They have really they're supporting their vision. I mean, they really support it. A lot of these mm-hmm. other films are survival tests. You know, Did I do enough good work to where this little movie that this guy's trying to do will it emerge? I mean, I can tell you we could have another hour on this subject, but of course those guys, and they have the money to fruition it, you know, and they want you, and you know, so it's a really there's many levels to this industry.
Melody and Destiny have kind of the same questions. You got a lot of questions from female listeners here. First of all, you found yourself kind of doing a lot of work in the horror genre. So first of all, is that a genre that you enjoy? And do you wish that you could do more comedies? So that's kind of a two-part question.
Well, I've done my first comic now, you know, and I've had comic moments, like one of the Millennium things that had me dressed up like Kirk Douglas in a blue trench coat, you know,
mm-hmm.
punching people in the nuts. I mean, it was very funny. It was. I enjoyed it very much. But the point was that horror films and science fiction, I've been blessed by having done, you know, quite a few westerns, and I love writing, and I'm good at all of that stuff. But they were all always morality plays, and they were always about something that was about people. And horror films, in a way, are a different deal. They're more about working out all the fears that are plaguing us. You know, about politics and about end of the world scenarios or religion or all the things that are privately we dread, you know, we can't solve. You mm-hmm. can't solve a ghost. You can't solve an alien coming in, you know, or turning to stone. You can't solve those things. So we do it on film to let people like lugubriate. I hate to use big words, but on the internet, whatever it is, right? And that's a different issue. That's a different deal, and that's what that is like. Whereas science fiction now is taking the place of a lot of, you know, what westerns used to do, you know, which is great morality plays and dealing with the state of the world in a different way. You know, like trying to game the powers that be right now into seeing where we're headed. Why don't they get the message? I mean, you know, anyway.
Well, that's true, and horror films are designed, we talk about this a lot on the show, are kind of uniquely designed to deal with those kind of societal, kind of sociological problems in a way that's...
Right, they're certainly not shaming anybody into anything. What they're doing is, you know, acting it out so that you can say, whew, that is not going to happen to me, I know that, you know what I mean? Mm.
Yeah.
The other one, you know, science fiction, when it's at its best, is really a kind of a mixture of the impossible becoming possible, but it mm-hmm. also, like, well, look at what Avatar was. I mean, that's like an incredible political statement, but it's also this joy of that there is something maybe better than just being a human being banging their head against the wall, you know?
Yeah. And before I let you go, one quick last question. You've done so many great films, delivered so many great performances. In your own estimation, when you look back,
you're not going to ask me that one, are you? You're not going to ask me that.
I'm not going to ask you. I'm not going to ask you necessarily about film, but are there moments you've created as an actor that you look back on and say, "Yes, that's the tops. That's something that I'm very proud of."
Yeah, at the end of Powder, I remember Powder goes back into the universe. I mean, his brain is so connected to the universe that he ends up literally vanishing in front of our eyes, and it was a big concussion. Poof, it went out in all directions, and it hit us. And Victor Salvo, who directed that, wrote and directed it, he thought it was going to have to be a very special moment when we felt the essence of this character that now has been, you know, absorbed back into the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't tell us how to do it. And I remember spontaneously when we did that moment, if you cross your arms in front of you and put your hands on your face because your arms are crossed, you're really feeling what your father's face looked like or felt like.
Hmm.
Because your arms are crossed, it gives a different interpretation of what you're feeling. And for some reason, that came to me, and I did it. And it brought out this emotional reaction that I didn't even expect. And that was one of my favorite movies on film. Because to me, it doesn't matter the struggle, the sweat that goes into doing a character. What really matters is what real and what spontaneously happens while you're filming.
Yeah.
You get what I mean? It's like
mm-hmm.
a moment, just a moment that is so somehow alive and human and resonates. And that's to me what I'm searching for all the time.
Thank you so much for not only your book, but all the work that you've done throughout your life to inform what is in that book, you know, and making movies that mean so much to so many people, including myself. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Really, you know, that's really nice of you to say that. We're resonating, are we? Thank you for this.
Let's do it again sometime. I appreciate it very much. Thank you for tuning in to the Movie Geeks United Summer of 1986 celebration of James Cameron's Aliens. Tune in for our next installment, where we'll speak with cinematographer Rick Waite and actor Brian Thompson about the Sylvester Stallone film, Cobra.